This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. Stay tuned to hear details of how to get a 10% discount and a free domain name.
Coming up today, Tesco is launching its own smartphone. The Norwegian Army is getting its tank drivers to use Oculus Rift. Bonkbuster pioneer Mills & Boon is moving into transmedia storytelling. And there's now a 24-hour web TV channel dedicated to cats. We'll also be discussing whether we want to be using Twitter to update our Amazon shopping carts and the secrets we could be giving away as we pee. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to urine analysis and virtual reality assisted warfare. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And it's just us today.
I know.
There was that pregnant pause as you expected to have a third voice come onto the podcast.
Just us, guys.
Just us. Nate is still away. Hello, Nate. Hopefully he'll be listening to this.
And Beazle will be listening.
Beazle, the dog who disrupted the recording of the podcast last week, is not here, but I'm sure he will also be listening. But I'm kind of glad he's not here.
I don't know. It was infinitely entertaining watching him turn any object into an obstacle course.
Or a teething implement.
Yes, that wasn't great for the people that own bikes in this office.
Yeah, nor was it great for the fact that the podcast studio is sort of paired with the room that contains all of the amazing gear that we get sent in to review and to photograph.
Yes, so, very precious things.
Very precious. But anyway, let's get on with the news. Tesco has announced plans to release its own Android smartphone.
Wowza.
Wowza. Now, this follows the very successful launch of a tablet last year, the Huddle tablet, which it launched in September. And the phone, according to Tesco, is going to be launching by the end of the year and will offer access to a range of own brand services, including Tesco's banking tools and apps for online shopping. Whether or not that's a massive draw remains to be seen. But yes, the Huddle tablet was phenomenally popular. It's actually sold 500,000 units by April. That's, you know, within about 6 months. And Tesco has announced it's going to be launching another version later in this year. There's not a huge amount more information about the phone, but Tesco did tell us that they hope to replicate the success of Huddle with the phone, and it's likely to be positioned similarly. So we'll take from that it will have a powerful processor and hopefully a wallet-friendly price. Now, this does make quite a lot of sense for Tesco because it already runs a mobile network. You may know it. It's very imaginatively named Tesco Mobile. So this should be quite an easy win.
Yeah, I would have thought. I mean, they nailed it last time, and we're seeing more and more of these budget products come out. I think you had Audi and Argos last year amongst a few others, and they were all pretty successful. You know you're not getting a stellar product, yeah. But they're not aiming at people that want an iPhone.
Yeah, I do wonder though. I mean, the phone market is much more saturated than the tablet market is or was, so they're going to have quite a lot more competition, but they have such a big advantage by having an enormous distribution network, i.e. all Tesco retail stores, which I don't think you can go down in a single street without finding one of those.
Absolutely, and they have a bit of their own ecosystem going on. I think you can download their films they sell, can't you?
Yeah.
You could through the tablet. And yep. I'm sure there'll be kind of integrated services with this device.
So we'd be really interested to find out if you would be a potential Tesco phone purchaser. Do let us know. We are, as ever, on podcast@wired.co.uk. The second piece of news we're going to talk about today is the Norwegian Army using a virtual reality headset in its tanks.
Yes, indeed. It's tank drivers, which makes an awful lot of sense if you think about it, because, you know, despite being in this heavy armory that is just designed to destroy everything else, they're very vulnerable. You know, you can't you don't have a great range of vision, unless you pop your head out and have a look, and then you're kind of in trouble.
You don't really get the lovely windows or the kind of, well, you do have a sunroof, but you tend to try and keep it closed most of the time.
Absolutely, that sunroof can have grenades drop down. So Norway, who actually, well, I don't think of as someone that needs a lot of tanks, but perhaps they do, is leading the way with this technology, using Oculus Rift headsets so that their tank drivers are safer. So the Combat Lab there has joined with Making View, a firm that specializes in creating 360-degree experiences, and they've done this on a tank. It basically involves four cameras with spherical lenses on each side of the vehicle. The images from the cameras are uploaded to a PC in the vehicle that stitches them back into a normal view and sends them to Oculus Rift being worn. So it's quite interesting here. As you can imagine, you would take inspiration from video games, which is likely to do similar things. Things like overlaying maps or speed readings, you know, vital statistics from the tank.
How quickly is this tank going?
Is speed the number one thing you need to know? Maybe it's the speed of the vehicle coming towards you, or the missile.
Identifying the bogies,
Bogies, that's such a good word. Apparently a major, this was all from a TV channel called TUTV, I believe, in Norway, and they interviewed a major there who said he really thinks this is not far off at all, kind of thanks to Facebook. I know a lot of people were not that pleased about Facebook buying Oculus Rift.
Nor am I that pleased about Facebook entering the warfare business.
Well, yeah, but you say that, but as far as we know, as far as Facebook tells us, do we believe them? You know, Oculus Rift is an autonomous branch of its massively growing empire.
So Facebook's keeping its sticky little paws out of its data.
Exactly. And, you know, Oculus Rift, it kind of supplies its equipment to people to do with what they will. And this is what they've done. And when you compare the prices, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, because there are some sort of technology a little bit like this that's already used within a military context, but it's just much more expensive.
Exactly. They have kind of elements of this, like the cameras they would use are $100,000 versus kind of $2,000 ones that they were using on Oculus Rift.
Okay.
And they have kind of a version of the goggle, military goggles, that would probably have night vision and stuff. But they're $34,650 more.
Wowza.
Than Oculus Rift. So it's fairly ridiculous numbers there. So I don't know, is it a good thing? I guess they're democratizing warfare, guys. So making it low cost for everybody.
I do sometimes think with these kind of these contracts with military, with armies, that tech companies charge ludicrous prices. I know there is a lot of R&D involved in some of these things, but you do sometimes think either, you know, it's a government contractor or, you know, or military unit, let's charge through the roof. I mean, we had a big article in Wired magazine a couple of months ago that was looking at the government digital services in the UK and their procurement of computers, and they were found to be paying £7,000 for a single computers that should cost, you know, less than a grand. But anyway, we digress.
But that's, I think that's absolutely be happening all the time. You think, you know, we assume military has a massive budget, and what you've seen in the last few years is everybody's broke and they're hemorrhaging money into the military and having to make huge cutbacks on personnel. So maybe something like this would prevent countries like the UK having to, you know, fire thousands of soldiers. Or
But you've had quite a VR heavy week, haven't you? It's not the only virtual reality story we've got from you.
No, Liv, I had quite an exciting day today. I had a shark attack me.
Not in the real world,
in
though.
In Soho. No, it was fine.
Famous sharks of Soho.
They are nasty. They're always drunk. So I went to a demo of Project Morpheus, PlayStation's VR offering, which was really interesting, actually, because they're kind of taking a step back and saying, you know, obviously you have to build this from the ground up. They're calling it, like, you know, the Wild West of video game producing, because it's like when we went from 2D to 3D, they're saying this is completely different and you have to take a step back and see how is a user going to experience this.
So at the moment it's kind of being driven by the technology, like the technology's been developed and the games aren't really there yet to support the technology.
Yeah, and I think that's partly because you don't know how people, an audience, is going to react to it. Like, I screamed a lot when the shark attacked me.
Yeah, so talk us through your experience. Like, what actually happened?
Okay, so there was a couple ones. The shark one, first of all, was called The Deep. And
but you put on a headset.
You
like
put on the headset.
Rift.
You put on headphones. The thing I do like, I tried Oculus Rift before, and the difference with Morpheus was that, or I don't think they had this with Oculus Rift, there's a little gap in your field of vision, so you can look down and see yourself if you, you know, so you don't panic.
Okay.
which I found very helpful when the shark was attacking. So we've got the headphones on, and you can hear someone in your ship talking to you, and you're put in a cage, going cage diving, and you can use the controls only to chuck flares out into the water, or drop the cage and go deeper.
Okay.
So the first stage is what they call the assimilation stage, where you're supposed to just enjoy the environment and fish swim about you. They don't know that I'm a super paranoid person that's scared of the sea, so I didn't assimilate. I was just terrified and waiting for a shark to attack me, which they promised wouldn't happen.
And it did.
And it did. Circled me, and it just freaks you out.
And what was it like, the experience?
Oh, it was horrible, because, I mean, some people might just think this is really, really fun. I am really scared of kind of deep open water and sharks, like a lot of people, I guess. And, you know, because obviously you've got a 360-degree field of vision, you can look, you look at your feet, you can bend down, you can see your flippers, and you can see your legs moving when you bend. But when you look
behind you, a video sensor monitoring your movement as well.
So there was just this, I was standing directly in front of one sensor, and it would calibrate. It just calibrated first off where I was holding it, the position. Mm. And once I did that, everything was fine. And, that, you know, it was just one small sensor. There was no other kit whatsoever. I was just holding a normal PlayStation controller to maneuver around. It can see.
And so the shark attacked the cage.
First, he circled me, Liv. Yeah. What I hated was looking behind me and seeing nothing, and then turning around to the front, and his face was right there. And then he destroyed my ship above, and I could hear bits calling. I could hear a woman screaming down the microphone, and then he went for me and ripped my cage to pieces and came at me.
So quite a fun, well, not fun for you, but a demo which showcased the technology very well, but not really a game. It wasn't, you know, very interactive.
No, exactly. They did have a game where you fly a spaceship, but I was just rubbish at that because I didn't get used to it. It was like 3 minutes and I didn't have time to get used to the controls. Okay. And that was fun, but it's kind of the experiences that are so far, I think they put a lot more attention in.
Yeah.
There's one called The Castle, and that was really great because you can see your hands, which you can't on a lot of them. I did an Oculus Rift one walking across the plank, and the worst thing there was you couldn't see your feet.
Yeah.
So here you could see your hands, and you could pick up swords, and you could grip. You just pressed a button and it was your grip, make a fist. I could punch people, which was great. Yeah. I could slay dragons.
But it's still very much like, you know, when you have those amazing preview little mini films of insects up close when they're trying to demo either HD or 3D tech. Like, they are hyper, you know, optimized for
absolutely.
That experience, but they're not ultimately probably how the real experience is going to be in the future.
Absolutely. It reminded me of Disney years ago when I went, I think it was Disney World or something, Disneyland, and they had a 3D show there.
Yeah.
And it was like the full thing, you know, you could hear noises underneath your feet, and there was wind, and there was all the rest of it.
Yeah.
That makes it really special. It remains to be seen what it's like in the home.
The third piece of news we're going to talk about today is Mills and Boone, who you may or may not know were the pioneers of the Bonkbuster. Way before we had 50 Shades of Grey, we had Mills and Boone and their romance / sexy novels, and they're doing something quite interesting.
I think so. I think for a brand that is, it's over 100 years old, first launched by Harlequin Publishers in the UK. That's right. We make sexy stuff. You'd think it's a very kind of old school brand. You've probably seen their 80s covers or, you know, their 60s covers. They look really cheesy. But you might be surprised to know that they sell one book every 4 seconds, and they produce 100 new titles on a digital format every single month, which is ridiculous, I think.
Boom,
exactly. Blow your mind there. Erotica everywhere. So I think that's kind of insane. And I think that, you know, they're picking up on the fact that their readers are very much into reading it in on different devices and different formats.
Probably because they're too embarrassed to have the cover on show on the tube or whatever form of public transport you might get.
Absolutely. But can you imagine a beaming screen with, like, and then his member? I don't want to say more than that.
It would definitely be member, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I think I would like to count how many in their, like, billions of titles they've produced say member. Anyway, first off, they actually launched their own e-reader app last month. So basically they're kind of taking ownership, saying we don't want to rely on a third party to sell our product. We're going to make our own e-reader and dedicated app. And they've got, you know, little bits of flack from people who say, this isn't your business, stick with what you're doing. But I like that they're kind of experimenting because they have such a massive business, you know, such a production rate. So now they're launching a transmedia storytelling platform called The Chatsfield.
Now, transmedia storytelling is such a buzzword, but it's basically, as the name suggests, but communicating a story which might be partly in writing on a, you know, an e-reader, partly over social media, partly in videos. It's kind of a multimedia approach to a story.
Absolutely. And they've kind of, they've really like thrown everything at this one. They're kind of using it as this massive experiment. And like you say, using all kinds of formats.
Okay. So talk us through it.
Right. I'll set the sexy scene for you. It's in a hotel, the Chatsfield. there's the chambermaid with a secret, the bartender with a secret. The various characters like this.
All with secrets.
All with secrets. All very dramatic. And then there's basically the main protagonist who's supposed to be like fun-loving girl looking for love, supposed to be giving up dating for 6 months, blah blah blah. So you're introduced to her through videos she posts on YouTube, where she kind of blogs about her experiences and talks to you, and she'll drop hints along the storyline so that you can then suddenly hack into her email. And the way they do this is, if you go on the Chatsfield website, it looks like quite a nice, you know, boutique hotel's website, and you can navigate around it to go to different rooms. So head to the bar and you'll be able to interact with the bartender's life. That might mean things like clicking on his iPad to get his email address, and then you can email him. And the best part is you actually get replies. And it's the same with her. You kind of go around her room in like a, you know, old school point and click, but a really bad one. You will, you know, click on her phone to get her phone number. You'll click on her computer and maybe watch one of her webisodes and stuff like that. But it is, it has, I think it has a kind of fun side to it because it is supposed to be light, but there is a little bit of a thrill about tweeting a character and them tweeting you back, yeah, which is what they're going to do.
Voyeuristic as well, isn't it? Especially with this subject matter, there's probably something quite exciting about being able to sort of dig into people's private lives, even more so.
Absolutely, you know, and I think that's the fun. Like Mills and Boone has basically made its name with very formulaic plots. They're not trying to be high art. It's light entertainment, and that's kind of what this is. But it gives you, it kind of exactly what you're saying. It plays on that voyeuristic side. So I think it's really fun. I think they're going to have a murder mystery story a lot somewhere down the line as well.
And is the idea that you follow this on a long-term basis? Is the story evolving and being updated as it go along, or is it complete and you can experience it now from start to finish?
So you can't, if you log on now, you're not going to be able to know the whole story. The way they've basically done it in real time, I began a couple of days ago, the beginning of May, and it rolls out over a 3 month period.
Okay.
But you can then access it in 3 months time and obviously catch up and read through all her old emails and
but it
will obviously, I think it will work better if you're kind of tracking it week to week and keeping up with the storyline, because it will move on without you. But they're going to kind of monitor, you know, which formats are being used most, which characters are getting more attention, and hopefully build on that and kind of fine tune it, because you might not want to ever tweet the bartender.
So maybe they can have a sort of Netflix style data driven approach to soft porn publishing.
Exactly. That is pretty much, I think it's pretty cool what they're doing. You know, they're kind of trying everything. They're not saying we've nailed it. They're saying this is an experiment. We'll see what people think is fun.
And this also opens them up to new revenue streams by the sounds of it. I think they've partnered with a dating site. So it means that suddenly a publisher can generate revenue from dating, an affiliate model.
Absolutely. So they've got several brand partners, and that was kind of one of my first questions. You know, is this a marketing ploy? Is this just a way to kind of suck revenue in really lame ways? You're going to have brands all over the website and brands all over the Twitter stream if you go to the individual's Twitter stream. So what they're doing here is they're promising me that they're very fine elements and they're always pertinent to the storyline, because the main thing is to keep readers. So a dating site, I think it's cupid.com, you'll see emails in the protagonist Jessie Lowe's email inbox with kind of promotional stuff from them, which actually just makes it look like anybody's inbox and is kind of relevant because she's a dating hoe. So I think it's okay.
I think this sounds really interesting. The only thing is, these sorts of stories are not, publishers aren't geared up to creating these sorts of stories. They're much more complicated to put together. Mm. I think if it works, you know, you end up having engagement over a much longer time with your audience, 3 months, and you can keep their attention. And if you can sell them other stuff in the process, it could be an interesting approach. But I suspect it'll prove to be a lot of work and perhaps not as much revenue as they would hope for.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't believe that actually you can leave voicemails and you'll get text replies and people are going to be there to text you back, you know. So imagine if it did explode, you're going to have a lot of upkeep. But who knows? I think it's the right brand to try something like this, because yeah. It isn't high art. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be light. You know, they don't have to answer to really picky authors that are like, you've destroyed my art.
What are you saying about Mills and Boone?
Sorry, you're all really artistic and wonderful. I don't mean it like that. I just mean, you know, that people are not, well, okay, I'm going to stop pulling my head.
Well, if you are a Mills and Boone author and have been angered by any comments, please do email us on podcast@y.co.uk. Now we come on to our final piece of news for this week, and it's an important one. Stop whatever you're doing. There is now a 24-hour TV channel on the internet that plays nothing but cat videos. And it's called, surprise, surprise, Cats 24/7. And it's one of the new channels on a media service called Pluto TV.
Livia, this is amazing.
It is amazing. It's what the internet has been calling for. And it's not dissimilar to what the internet does already.
I was going
to
say, it kind of sounds like the internet.
Yeah. So I watched some of it this morning. And the first thing I saw was a white spade-faced cat wearing a blue wig and eating some rice balls.
Yummy.
A little later, I got to see a ginger cat being made to dance to dubstep by his human puppet master.
That's animal cruelty.
As I said, stop whatever you're doing. This is important. and this is all part of one of the two-hour shows on the channel called Putting Up With Humans. And it's probably a bit of a stretch to call it a show, because it was really just a sequence of YouTube videos that were sort of smushed together. And other shows that they've got include Kitten Zone, which I think you can guess what happens in that, and Scaredy Cats, which is described as, watch as cats lose their cool when they receive an unexpected surprise. Now, I would have thought that, first of all surprises are unexpected. That's kind of the point. But secondly, that has potential to be really mean.
Oh, but those are some of the funniest ones on YouTube.
Yeah, but if you're not a cat person, Pluto TV also has Dogs 24/7, and it's a similar format. And it also has about 100 other channels across quite a broad range of topics. Now, the company behind it does try to claim that it's revolutionising the way that people enjoy video content online. But I would probably say that this is kind of just like a long YouTube playlist. It even has these kind of slightly weird anachronistic features, like being able to tape shows using this sort of personal video recorder. And it doesn't have a catch-up service.
So it's actually kind of gone back in time.
Well, it's gone forward in time, but then also got, you know, using some kind of old school features. Like, if you're watching it, you can record it, but you can't just say, oh, I want to watch what was happening 20 minutes ago. That's not possible.
That's insane.
And so the question I ask is this really fixing a problem?
I'm afraid, Olivia, it is not, for several reasons. As you've marked up, YouTube delivers beautiful compilations of surprised cats. And also, if there's a cat TV show, I'm going to be really disappointed if there isn't a storyline.
Yeah, well, I think we should perhaps put these comments to Pluto TV, and hopefully they'll be able to introduce a little bit more stronger narrative to your cat TV show, please.
We want some genres: romance, drama, murder.
Sex. No, not sex, that's weird. That's all the news this week, but still to come, we're going to be talking about Amazon's approach to hashtag sales, a partnership with Twitter, and we're also going to be talking about quantified toilets.
This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. The easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, responsive designs, and 24/7 customer support teams based in New York and Dublin mean you can create a beautifully designed website for as little as £5 a month. This includes a free domain name when you sign up for a year. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code WIRED to get 10% off and to show your support for Nate, Olivia, Liat and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team. No credit card is required to give the service a spin. Visit squarespace.com to support the show.
Hello, welcome back. The first segment in this second half is going to be WTAF. What the Actual Flip.
What the?
So last week, the internet was abuzz with a story of quantified toilets. Now, these were supposedly connected toilets that were carrying out analysis on the deposits made in them. Number ones, actually, not number twos, I think. And they were collecting data about the anonymous users' sexual health, blood alcohol level, drug traces, STDs, even things like pregnancy. However, do not fear, it was a hoax. And it was set up by some academics who were attending a technology conference. And what they did was they kind of created a little website and they posted signs in the venue's bathrooms saying that their data was being collected. Now, the whole prank was designed to tap into concerns about publicly accessible data. All of the stuff we give away for free without really thinking about
it. So they're saying this would not be a good thing, ultimately.
I don't think they were going as strong as that. They were just saying, this could be a thing. What do we think about it? But what I thought was interesting about this story is that all of the things that were supposedly being tracked in the hoax are completely possible to track them. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that this could happen right now. Like, we had our event Wired Health, we held it last week, and we had some people working on some incredible sensors. We had smartphone-sized devices that could detect cancer from your breath, voice apps that recognise Parkinson's, and tiny ingestible sensors that could be put into your pills and to monitor if patients are taking them or not. So it does raise some really interesting questions. You know, could companies with drug policies start to use this sort of system? Or what about companies worried about maternity payouts, if they could check who was pregnant?
That's a shocker.
That is a shocker. And so I guess the idea of the quantified self provides some really, really exciting opportunities. But healthcare data is incredibly personal, and it could be gathered by a company without your knowing. And another piece of technology that was raised in this article is something called IntelliMAT. And this is a pressure-sensitive surface that could potentially gathers data on the way that you move over it. And it's been found to be quite a good identifier of people. Just as we have fingerprints and, you know, our facial features that can be recognised using facial recognition, apparently the way that we walk is also a very good identifier. So it's entirely possible that a company or a shopping mall or an office might be able to put in place these mats on the floor and identify individuals from the way that they walk. I'm sure it'd be much cheaper to do something using low energy Bluetooth and their mobile phones, but it's just goes to show that there is this stuff that we're giving away, and as we collect this data, it then becomes vulnerable to being either hacked or accessed or used in the wrong way.
But I mean, so a lot of these things, obviously you have to have the conversations around them to stop exactly what you're saying from happening, from people using it in the wrong way. But I know in the piece it was kind of flagged up by someone that, you know, a concern of the gait recognition software would be security services and government using it, you know, for security purposes. But, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just, it's another thing. You know, we have so much stuff now, like you say, CCTV all the time, and you kind of have a not a social contract, but you know that this is something that is part of our world and it's supposed to be there to protect them, and you're supposed to protect the institutions. And I think actually in things like law enforcement, isn't it good to have more data so that you can avoid wrongful convictions? I actually think, you know, that more and more they're using things like this, and there is you know, talk of using these in cases in the future.
Well, okay, there's one thing, you know, when there's a conviction that's being questioned and it's being investigated, and so that data, you know, access to that data is granted, but it comes down to the mass collection of data. You know, if you had these sorts of toilets that were continually monitoring what was coming into them on with individual kind of, you know, patient level data, that's quite different from having a case where you want to, it's like mass surveillance, and, you know, those cases when collecting it just in case as a terrorist, as opposed to collecting it only when there's a suspicion of someone being a terrorist.
Absolutely. But I guess there's two things there. For the PE one, you know, I would have thought you have to have some serious disclaimers for using those toilets.
Yeah.
And if you're a company, you definitely more so, because you can't track your, I mean, you shouldn't be able to. I don't think that's something that should ever happen, basically.
Unless it was a controlled research
Unless
program.
It was at your GP's and it was a quick way to test your pee, so you don't have to pee all over your hand when you put it in a pot.
Or it was your own bathroom and you kept your own data and
you wanted to track it and share with your doctor.
Kidney function or what have you.
Absolutely. But on the security side, like the gait tracking thing, we already do that with CCTV. People are collecting vast amounts of data, and then actually other people are, they use it in airports. They want to use it in airports to track facial features.
Yeah.
And although you'll say, you know, everyone will say that's different from CCTV monitoring, that's just because it's like kind of the analog version of tracking people's features. It's the first step, but essentially that's what they're trying to do anyway.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about this whole healthcare space is, you know, traditionally healthcare data or personal data relating to your body. So maybe that includes the way you walk and the way you pee, not necessarily health per se. But this is data that's traditionally been very closely guarded. It's usually only been collected by medical professionals and it's been stored by them accordingly. But now we're getting loads of consumer interest in this data, and it is incredibly interesting for individuals. And so it means we've got consumer tech companies getting involved in this space. You know, Google patenting smart sugar monitoring contact lenses, for example, and Apple's rumored to be developing earphones that monitor your heartbeat. And so suddenly this data is kind of leaking out into the ether, into companies that perhaps don't have the same track record for safeguarding data as perhaps medical professionals might do.
Absolutely. And more we're getting used to kind of sharing our data without thinking about it in exchange for free services and everything. But I think at the end of the day, it's kind of, you know, you obviously want to be able to trust a company and only have trusted services do it. But on the other hand, I think there's also a leap of faith and having trust in institutions and companies. Like, we blindly trust our government, and we have done for years with loads of our personal data, and then you find out that they sell it to insurance companies, and they it's not a good example. And
well, that's
I didn't really
care.
Right?
Which we've discussed many times on this podcast before, but that is the data sharing program whereby the all the information stored at your GP is now going to be shared centrally, just in case you don't know that.
But also people can buy, anyone can buy your kind of personal information, where you live, and from the voting register roll,
electoral roll,
and have done for years. And I remember when I found that out, I was a bit unsettled. But I guess there is this line that you make a decision to kind of trust that this is going to make your life better.
Yeah.
Perhaps not with people taking my details from the electoral roll, but for your health, one of the most important things.
Well, I'd be really interested to find out what our listeners think. So, what are your thoughts on mass collection of urine samples, or, you know, biometric data collected via, you know, the way you walk? Tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. And now we're going to visit one of our favorite friends. We're going to ride the Technosaurus. Amazon's grubby little tentacles are extending even further into the web ecosystem, Liat.
Yes, Olivia. They haven't got enough money. They want more, we think, from this proposal. It's launching Amazon Cart, a way to basically tweet to purchase items, or at least reserve them for later.
So how does it work?
Right, yes. Very important, and I don't think people are going to use it much. You tweet using the hashtag Amazon Cart, and an item will be saved, but this only works if your Twitter and Amazon accounts are linked. And then if you spot a tweet containing an Amazon URL, you can retweet with the hashtag to add it to your shopping cart. We spoke to the CEO of a social infrastructure provider, Gigya, who basically said this is a solution in search of a problem. You know, they were saying that they've already perfected this system. Why mess with a good thing? And I kind of agree. I'm not really sure why they're doing this. You know, how often are you going to spot an Amazon URL in the feed unless you're following Amazon and looking for promotions or that type of thing? How often do your friends link to something in Amazon that they just love?
And how challenging is it to just find something on Amazon and buy it with one or two clicks?
Not very challenging, Olivia. In fact, you know, they're one click purchase. They've made it so easy. It's kind of strange. And, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but if you see someone posting a product in Twitter, it's usually something really silly or ridiculous. Or
if someone really wants an item of clothing, I occasionally see that sort of thing get posted. But the link would be to the page where you could buy it. So it wouldn't feel like, if the link is going to the Amazon page anyway, and then you can just put it into your shopping basket and buy it within a few clicks, I guess. But having said that, Amazon has done lots of studies to show that, you know, just by moving the button, the to buy button, it makes a massive difference in terms of the volume of purchases or conversions made. So maybe something like this could add to Amazon's ever incrementing revenue.
Yeah, and I guess at the end of the day, you want to make it as easy for consumers as possible, and you want to have them to have, you know, every possible avenue to get stuck in and make a purchase, so they can afford to trial something like this.
But do you think that shopping on Amazon is a social thing by nature? Do you want people, when we think about the last things you bought, I bought a lead for my dog and some plastic chewy bone toys also for my dog. I'm not sure anyone gives one, what word should I use, one dog poo about that, and why would I share that with my Twitter followers? It's
yeah.
boring.
No, I agree completely. I always think, you know, there's a range of purchases you make. They're either boring everyday stuff, they're embarrassing
that you don't want to buy in a real store,
or like every now and then you buy something really cool that you might want to brag about, but that's probably very rare. And if you're the type of person that wants to brag about the thing you're buying on Twitter, I don't want to be friends with you, and I'm probably not following you.
But I always wonder when Amazon launches stories like this that get a lot of press attention, when Amazon actually talks to the press actively, often it feels like they're trying to either hide something, so I'm not sure what else is brewing at Amazon, or yeah, just kind of distract people a little bit, or just generate a bit more PR buzz in a quiet month. I mean, we saw this with the Amazon drone delivery, which is obviously a ludicrous way to actually deliver products, especially in cities. And it was kind of just a pre-Christmas boost to Amazon's media coverage without actually having to pay for advertising.
And didn't it coincide with bad news?
And it coincided with lots of reports about the 0 hours contracts and the kind of whistleblowers of who people working in Amazon warehouses. I'd be really interested to know what our listeners think. Would you want to buy products from Amazon in this way? Do you want to share with your Twitter followers the mundane things that you're putting into your shopping cart? Is this useful? Is this time saving? Please let us know on podcast@y.co.uk. So we've now finished the discussion section of this week's podcast, and we are about to move into the feedback loop. Now, the first piece of feedback we have is in relation to something we talked about on this week's podcast, How Speedy Is That? It's talking about the 24/7 Cat TV channel. And, you know, in my article about this, I asked whether this was fixing a problem or not. And, you know, Liat's already said that she doesn't think it is. And Josh Russell agrees. He said, no, it's kind of fixing the solution. I'm happy the internet has killed curated content. I like picking and choosing what I watch and consuming and selecting what parts of a channel's output I want to engage with. I really don't need someone taking all of that and putting it back into a TV experience. Total backward step. Aside from 24-hour cats, that's a total goldmine right there.
Love you, Josh.
Love you, Josh, too.
So the next piece of feedback is from Roy Mather, who was commenting on the fact that this is the second week of all female voices on the podcast. He says, first, I was unaccountably weirded out because I'm so used to listening to predominantly male casts. Now I've flipped and get annoyed with all male casts. Amazing, Roy.
Yeah, we love you, Roy, as well.
Yeah.
He also left a very complicated emoticon smiley thing.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of winky face with eyebrows, nose, and a V smile.
So friendly face.
Friendly, or is it slightly sinister?
Friend or foe, friend Roy. Or foe.
And the final piece of feedback we have for this week relates to the Occupy Movement developed decision-making app that I think we spoke about in last week's episode, which was episode 172. And Philippa Hornsby said, after having my much-loved university literally trashed by members of the Occupy movement and their spin-offs, much to the aggravation of the general student body, I'm pleased to hear that someone from the group has actually achieved something positive. The crowdsourcing app is a very positive idea and sounds like it could work in lots of situations, although I have to say that it doesn't surprise me at all that the less belligerent members of the movement have problems getting their views. Heard at daily meetings. Great show as always, and I'm looking forward to the next edition. Well, you are in the next edition, Philippa, so welcome.
Hi, Philippa. And good point. I'm sad they trashed your uni. That is not what they should be about.
No. Well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap up for the week, and we very much look forward to seeing you, well, not seeing you, but being in your ears next week. Thanks very much.
Thank you.